Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the broth lady or the inventor of the hashtag more vegetables than a vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size and self-love and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne of thepaleomom.com. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip. So, Sarah, we waffled back and forth about what this show would be on varying topics last week, and I think that we told people that it was going to be Sugar Part 2, even though we also had another show that we were going to do that wasn't Sugar Part 2, but Sugar was going to be expanded. And then, because this is why we do the show weekly, and we don't have to, you know, we don't do transcripts and all that kind of stuff so that we can speak to things in a time-sensitive manner. Earlier this week, there was an article that came out, rebuttals and, you know, all this kind of stuff from an independent study that Dr. Kayla Daniels published, I guess. And we want to talk about that because it's important, and you've done a lot of research into rancidity of fats that I think is that's an understatement.
I didn't think I cared so much,
but now you
about
do. And what
rancid
I think
fats.
What I think is really great is that I don't know that anybody can find the information that you're going to provide both on your blog this week and on today's show from the science perspective of rancid fats and what may or may not be happening in particularly the Green Pastures fermented cod liver oil that everyone is talking about. So we've decided that we're going to dedicate the show to essentially fish fats. Is that how are we calling
fish
this?
Fats? I think we should just be like, this should be the great fermented cod liver oil debate of 2015.
Like, well, originally, before the debate like snowballed into where it is, we were like, okay, we'll just do a fish oil show because we also
that's been planned for like months.
Actually, Matt had asked us to do that show a while ago.
I think
because
at the beginning of the summer, he's like, we really do a fish oil show. Great idea, Matt.
Right. And so, particularly because there's several kinds of different fish fats that you can buy, and you know,
sustainability questions are different, and the quality questions are different. Yeah.
And so we were going to just do a fish oil show focused on that. But we were going to touch on this topic, and then as the topic snowballed, we feel that there is way more information than we can cover and everything that surfaced to give the clarity on these items that we think they deserve to do anything else. But before you jump into all of that and the science and even the background of what this is for people that might not know, I personally wanted to kind of just jump into where my passion is on this, because you're going to touch a lot on...
Because there might be somebody out there who still doesn't know exactly what we're talking about.
I was going to get there, I promise.
So, like, give the broad... I think we still need to give the broad strokes.
Okay.
You go get... You do it. That's what I'm just saying.
Okay.
Go ahead. You're on.
So, the broad stroke of the snowball is that a lot of the whole food community has recommended for a really long time a brand of fermented cod liver oil called Green Pastures. Green Pastures makes and manufactures a variety of products, from butter oil to fermented cod liver oil to butter oil blend to a face cream that uses those kinds of oils and fats. You can, you know, find out a lot about them from basically anyone's blog or, you know, podcasts in the community. A lot of people have recommended them for a really long time. And years ago, even you and Sarah and I were saying, you know, that we thought that it was a great choice for people to get a nutrient dense boost, kind of a supplement, so to speak. And then the more kind of we learned, specifically Sarah, about whole food sources and the importance of getting nutrients from whole foods, because that's how your body knows to process things. You can call it synergy, or you can, you know, just think about it in the context of those foods have always been together, and the best way to protect certain parts of them is to keep them together, which is why Sarah and I focus on nutrient density of food, and why, you know, I think it was about 2 years ago, you and I both, when you were doing the book for the Paleo Approach, and then when we wrote Real Life Paleo and we talked about the phase three nutrient dense foods, really, instead of talking about that as a supplement, focused on incorporating seafood as part of your paleo template in a much more highly consumable amount than most people are doing.
I think where I came to that was looking at, you know, I was looking at seafood and I was looking at liver. And other organ meat, which fermented cod liver oil, like, gets the best of both worlds, right? Or that's the idea anyways. But I was looking at, you know, the nutrients in these things and how much of that is not fat soluble, right? Like the proteins and the water soluble vitamins and minerals, and how much nutrition you miss out on as soon as you extract something, right? So as soon as you're just isolating the oil, you're missing out on like amazingly important nutrients. And I just, you know, there was this, and we've talked about it on the show before, there's this, you know, labeling of fermented cod liver oil as a whole food supplement. I'm like, cod livers would be a whole food. Cod liver oil is an extracted oil. And I feel like it's almost like calling soybean oil a whole food. It's, I mean, if you did that, it sounds preposterous, right? Like, who would call soybean oil of a whole food? That's ridiculous. It's, you know, has to go through this amazing, you know, high pressure, whatever extraction process in order to get it out of the soybean. But even though it's not as hard to get the oil out of cod livers, it's still an extraction and you're still throwing something away. And unfortunately, what you're throwing away is deliciousness.
Well, and not just deliciousness, but I think, at least for me, and certainly before all of this came out, like, I didn't understand the mechanism for all of how it came out and all that kind of stuff. But what I understood from kind of a nebulous level was that the fermentation process was different than high heat extraction, which is why it was important that it come from a fermented cod liver oil versus, like, say, the fish oil that you buy over the counter at GNC that's in capsules and is most certainly almost certainly rancid before you've even bought it because of the way that the process comes about. So, all of that said,
we will get into
much more detail, but just the broad strokes. That's kind of the history on it. And then earlier last week for you all, this week for us, Dr. Kayla Daniels came out with a report that she had a third party evaluate Green Pastures products, and the findings were different than what one would expect from the claims and information that is provided by the brand. And so there's been a lot of discontent within the community about...
There's been a lot of picking sides and like
pointing fingers and
throwing
picking sides.
Things at each other.
Right.
Words mostly. Throwing words at each other mostly. But still, not nice words.
Which is where my background was going to come into play. So for me, while I am super interested in hearing your information on the science of the fats, because as someone without a gallbladder, I've talked endlessly about how important consumption of quality fats are for me. And quality is a subjective word in this case, in terms of what kind of fats work in my body, whether they be whole food source or not, don't necessarily reflect what might work in someone else's and vice versa. So what I mean by quality fats is particular to me. So anyway, I'm interested in it from that perspective, but I'm more interested in the finger pointing and the picking of sides that is happening. Because for me, one of the things that I, not as a leader in the community, but as a member of the community, find is really important is the fact that we're all really interested in finding out the answers and doing full fact checking and being really honest with one another in the community. And if someone, you know, finds out, for example, Chris Kresser several years ago talked to Rob Wolf about his recommendation of, you know, high dose fish oil consumption. And that, what was like probably 4 years ago.
And maybe three. I'm thinking it was more like three.
And Rob,
I remember listening to those podcasts.
Right.
That was back in the days when I had time to listen to the podcast.
Which is why I think it's more like 4 years ago. But anyway, so Rob Wolf did what I think is like the most respectable thing that anyone could do. He said, I was wrong. This guy gave me some awesome information. Here's what I learned. And here's my revised recommendation based off of the information that I now know. And that is what I truly, honestly respect and love about this community. It's different than, you know, what you might find in the mainstream media about things, right? Like, it takes a really long time before anyone's willing to say that they were wrong because they don't, you know, want blame anywhere and blah, blah, blah. And instead of us worrying about those kinds of things, we're able just to say, look at this great thing that we've learned. Now we can all be better and healthier for it. And my concern, more than anything in this situation, is that it all started from a decision made by the president of the Weston A. Price Foundation, Sally Fallon, to not investigate when concerns were brought up by the board themselves at Weston A. Price Foundation, and later on expanded and steamrolled into the thing that it is now. And there was dissension in the board about how they handle this. And, you know, there are a lot of articles on the web. And some of the most interesting things for me are about a brand offering to pay a all-expense-paid trip for you to come take a tour of their facility. That would be something that we in our community would totally lambast Monsanto for doing that, right? Like, if you saw one of the, you know, government leaders be provided an all expense paid trip to come visit their fields and see how healthy and beautiful they are, and then they go home and like they've seen what they want to see on the time clock that the brand wants to show it to them and all that kind of stuff, versus like, you know, someone coming in randomly and seeing that people have to wear gas masks and they get sick and, you know, all the things that we know are true about pesticides, for example. And that's kind of an exaggerated point, kind of like you were making, Sarah. But I want to point out that, you know, the decision by some parties to either take brands up on that opportunity or to say, no, I'm not comfortable with that, have come to light in this situation in a way that makes me concerned for the community not being honest and open in interest to find the truth that we would hope to see in the community. And this is consistent with Sarah and I's experience with particularly Sally Fallon and the Weston A. Price Foundation. It was back in episode 49. I looked it up almost 2 years. It was over 2 years ago because it was July 2013. That we ourselves were dealing with an attack. The paleo community was dealing with an attack from the Weston A. Price Foundation, saying that we were an unhealthy organization. And P.S., we're not an organization. Nobody's at the head of anything. We're just a community of people with the same lifestyle interests that was promoting a low-fat lifestyle. And I think for a lot of us, we know that not to be true. We know that many, many leaders in the community, I can only think of two, that promote low fat or lean protein, as it's called. But most people in the community talk about healthy fats as being essential to the paleo diet because you need fat in order to properly absorb nutrients. We talk about what kinds of fat are healthy. We talk about eating, you know, sustainably, humanely raised animals and eating their like whole animal and eating their fat and making your own lard and tallow. We talk about eating their organ meats. We talk about all the same, very similar philosophies that the Weston A. Price Foundation themselves supports. So it was quite shocking when 2 years ago the community was attacked, and not just a little bit. You can go back and read that episode. I'm not gonna.
And I also wrote a fairly epic blog post at that time.
I did too. Yeah.
We can make sure that those are linked in the show notes.
Yeah. So my point to all of this is to say that 2 years ago, Sarah and I made a decision that I won't speak for you, Sarah. I made a decision that I was no longer going to be associated with the Weston A. Price Foundation. I didn't renew my membership and I decided that I didn't want to be part of an organization whose MO was to be so, what I felt was manipulative, defensive, and kind of go into attack mode on something. And I didn't feel like that was the positive approach for the community to kind of learn and grow. And what's interesting to me is that this article has brought about very similar results as was 2 years ago within the paleo community, but it's within the Weston A. Price Foundation's real food community itself. And so that's why we're seeing a lot of dividing and choosing sides and pointing fingers. And what we hope to accomplish here today is a lot less of that, a lot less of subjective feelings and beliefs and personal experiences. And Sarah's going to deliver what she always delivers, which is the facts about, you know, what the findings were, both, you know, some things that were done right, some things that were not done right. And also, a lot of information about the rancidity of fats so that listeners can make educated, informed decisions, which is something that perhaps before this day you could not have properly done because of information that was either manipulated or intentionally kept from the community, which is a hard pill to swallow. And I feel badly kind of making that quote unquote accusation, but I wasn't there. So it, you know, I can't definitively say, but I can say from my own personal experience as an attack that that is consistent with my experience. And it is disheartening to see it continue to happen. But I do sincerely hope that the result of this is that the Weston A. Price Foundation community becomes aware of the decisions that their leadership are making and that changes can be made so that that organization can come back to what I feel like its founding, you know, Dr. Weston A. Price himself would have wanted, which is, you know, the investigation and truth and honesty into things that really help or hinder people from being healthy rather than what people in the industry might refer to as bowing to sponsors. And I will say that Sarah and I promote brands. So we're not, you know, completely removed from this sort of behavior, but I can honestly say that from a personal perspective, I turn down more interested parties than I accept.
Oh, abs like maybe five times as right. many, like a lot more. Yeah.
And I have absolutely like outright rejected cash being thrown at me to promote things that I personally would not consume or endorse. And so, you know, I want to take the stance that Rob Wolf took 3 or 4 years ago and say, you know, if you consumed something that, you know, now we believe is, you know, new information has surfaced or we've gained knowledge on something and we no longer recommend it. And you feel like, you know, I gave you a wrong recommendation back then, you know, I sincerely apologize. And that's why we're focused on, you know, being always honest and open with people about the information that we have on hand all the time. That said, neither Sarah or I are medical professionals, so we can neither diagnose or give you medical information. So everything that we share with you is always based off of either the science that Sarah finds, the research, and that is straight fact-based research that she shares, or our own personal experiences. So does that give you the base that you need to take this ball and run with it, Sarah? Anything I missed?
I think that's amazing. I think I'm good. Yeah. In fact, I might not even have to cover as much as I was planning on covering. It was excellent. So, you know, what I really want to do is talk about Dr. Kayla Daniels' report, sort of vilifying fermented cod liver oil. And there's been a number of responses, and the responses sort of fall under three categories. So there's the, you know, people who are basically undermining the information in Dr. Daniels' report and saying that it, you know, the conclusions she drew from those tests are wrong for whatever reason, and they are still, you know, firmly in the pro fermented cod liver oil camp. There's the people who have rallied behind Dr. Daniel, and then there's the people who are like, well, there's this and there's this, and maybe they'll, you know, recommend a different type of conclusion from one measurement, but say that this other kind of measurement is concerning. And there's been quite a few people who've sort of come down on this sort of, I recommend caution. I want to hear more of the story and I'm going to be neutral. And I think, you know, really by the end of this podcast, that's probably where we're going to fall. But at the same time, you know, for me, what I'm seeing is, perhaps some misunderstandings of science. And I kind of want to clear up as much of that as I can. I'm also working on a sort of epic blog post that'll go into all of these sort of tests and what they say and what they don't say in detail that should be live by the time this show airs. So if you're listening to this now, you can hop on over to thepaleomum.com and look for that. So, you know, it's very, very interesting that fermented cod liver oil is considered a traditional food, yet Green Pasture is the only company that makes and sells it. And it was released in 2007. And it has been highly recommended by the Weston A. Price Foundation ever since, and basically, you know, usurped the position of cod, like regular cod liver, as now like the best supplement to take. And, you know, Stacy's point of, you know, at that time, high profile members of the Weston A. Price Foundation executive were flown out, you know, for a paid private tour by Dave Wenzel, who was the founder of Green Pasture. And they were shown how this fermented cod liver oil was made, but nobody else knows how it's made. So the actual process of fermentation remains a secret. And so one of the very, very first criticisms that Dr. Daniel makes is, well, how can you ferment oil? You need to have something for a bacteria to eat. And, you know, especially lactic acid producing bacteria, which are sort of the dominant, you know, family of bacteria that are used for fermenting foods, they can eat a huge range of things. So they can eat some proteins, they can eat a whole huge range of different types of carbohydrates, but you need something for them to eat. Now, when you start to look at the language on Green Pasture's site, they actually say that they ferment the cod livers themselves as a method of extracting the oil. And that suddenly changes the equation, because liver is one of the major glycogen storage sites in the body. And so there actually, that is a carbohydrate, is glycogen. So that is something that could be fermented. And then there would be some proteins as well. And in a lot of meat fermentation, because there's a lot of traditionally fermented sausages, you know, a lot of the same ideas would come into play there, that you need some carbohydrate to ferment. So, you know, if the glycogen store in that meat is not sufficient to drive the fermentation, then sugars can be added. And because we don't know how fermented cod liver oil is actually produced, we don't know. Like, it sounds like they are mixing the cod livers with some kind of starter and letting them go. And then perhaps all the oil is separating out through that process, and then they take the oil and bottle it. We don't know. And it becomes so difficult to draw any conclusions when you're talking about it sort of a secret manufacturing process. And I think that's going to be one of the things that's going to help answer these questions the most, is if, Dave Wenzel actually shares his methodology, or at least to the point where, you know, people can actually start to understand exactly how that the cod liver oil is fermented. So Green Pasture started in 2007. The first real rumblings of this might not be a miracle cure, this might actually be harmful, actually came from Dr. Ron Schmidt, who he does Dr. Ron's Ultra Pure supplement company that's based, I believe, out of Australia. And he was taking very large doses of fermented cod liver oil and ended up going into heart failure. And so this is a quote from him. So he wrote, "In the 6 years I took fermented cod liver oil, I went from running 10 miles a day to being barely able to walk across the room. My cardiologist, a world-renowned physician at Yale New Haven Hospital named Mark Mariab, was at first skeptical of my theory that cod liver oil had caused my heart problems. But as he followed what he calls my miraculous recovery from advanced heart failure, the usual prognosis is death within 3 to 6 months. And when first admitted to Yale New Haven, I was seen by the heart transplant team. He has gradually accepted that the cause of my heart failure was excessive amounts of cod liver oil." And so Ron was like the first person to really, you know, start to say, I think I was taking a lot of this. I was fine before, and then I wasn't fine afterwards. And when he started sharing that, you started to see comments from other people. I had the same experience. And then Nourished and Nurtured shared sort of a similar story. And again, sort of like, it just became this sort of like public, like, you know, I think that oil's bad. And if anybody who's tried the regular, you know, it does have it is vile. I mean, there's no other way to describe the flavor. It's vile. It burns. And so just because of that, you know, it being bad is a sort of human reaction to the flavor. So, in March 2014, Corganic brand, is sort of a competitor, started carrying extra virgin cod liver oil. It's not fermented. And Dan Corrigan jumped into this debate, again, talking about what I already talked about, is like, how can you even ferment cod liver oil? And Sally Fallon then threatened to ban Corrigan from Weston A. Price Foundation events, which then, of course, got tempers very, very heated. So Dr. Daniel reports that in December 2014, so just last December, it's sort of in response to these, you know, sort of debates that were happening all over the, you know, sort of all over the place, but not clearly within the paleo community because we were mostly unawares at the time. They voted against independently testing the Green Pasture fermented cod liver oil. And it was based on Sally Fallon's very, very strong beliefs that this was amazing and Dave Wetzel's assurances. And Dr. Daniel was advised to just relax, and it's her quote, "leave the science to people who could be fair to Dave and to toe." And she was advised to toe the fermented cod liver oil line, which is what Stacey was referring to earlier, as sort of being like the, you know, this is where certainly I start to feel like that's not a very scientific way to approach a question.
While it is completely hearsay, it is consistent with our own personal experience with how we have seen that kind of response come from Sally.
Well said. So in February, Dr. Daniel, who was not at all happy with how the Weston A. Price Foundation, she was on the board of the Weston A. Price Foundation. She wasn't happy with how the board was handling it. In February, the Weston A. Price Foundation released a rebuttal of all these concerns about fermented cod liver oil being rancid, and citing quality assurance testing that Dr. Daniel said was never actually done. So Dr. Daniel decided to send in her own samples for testing. And then in August, she released a, I think it was like 110-page report. I mean, this was just like 10 days ago, I think she published it, or 9 days ago, for free. And it's freely available on her website. And we can put a link in the show notes for anybody who want to go back, go to that 110-page report and read it. So, and then of course, all the opinions have all been shared, and it's been a really surprisingly heated debate. It's been really interesting to be sort of on the periphery of it. So in Dr. Kayla's report, the very first thing that she's talking about is this idea of, can this even be fermented? And she has some, you know, some interesting data to support that. And one of them is that the pH of the fermented cod liver oil, she sent the report to five different labs. So she had five different labs run analysis on the samples. The analysis came back with a pH between the range of 5.17 and 5.8, which is acidic, but not actually as acidic as fermented foods. So other fermented foods typically have to reach a pH of 4.6 or lower to be considered fermented. So if you're home fermenting sauerkraut, you know, one of the strategies for making sure, you know, that your sauerkraut is fermenting well, making sure that it's safe, you know, making sure that it's ready, is checking the pH. And so a pH of 5.2 raises some questions about how shelf stable the product is, because one of the purposes of fermentation is to make sure that you, you know, you have a product that can be stored for a long period of time. And this may be the fact that the pH of fermented cod liver oil does not ever get that low, maybe one of the reasons why it needs to be stored in the fridge. But that's one of her main concerns. She then looked at a bunch of different markers of oil rancidity. And this was something I didn't know a lot about, and I had to do a lot of reading about exactly how fats can go rancid. So how do they go bad? And it turns out that there's three sort of different ways that a fat can go bad. So there's oxidative rancidity. So that's where the fats are reacting with oxygen. So the oxygen is degrading the fats. And we've talked about oxidized fats, oxidative damage from fats, right? Oxidative damage is one of the things that propels aging. It's inflammatory. We've talked about that a lot on the show. And it's really interesting to you know, make the reference again to Chris Kresser and Rob Wolf's discussions about high dose of fish oil from 3 or 4 years ago, because the main reason why high doses of fish oil were not health promoting beyond a short window of something like 4 to 6 weeks was because as soon as you extract those oils from the fish, the fats are more fragile and they're more susceptible to oxidative damage. And so while when you first take fish oil, you're correcting omega-3 to omega-6 imbalances in the human body really quickly, after that original correction has happened in the, you know, 4 to 6 week window, the regular consumption of oxidized fats then, you know, builds up this oxidative damage in the human body, which can be inflammatory. It can, you know, then start to cause other problems, increase cardiovascular disease risk and things like that. And so that is the mechanism that we're used to thinking about when we're talking about fats going bad. It's one of those buzzwords that we've talked about a lot in the paleo community, but it is not the only way that a fat can go rancid. So the other mechanism, that's the sort of main mechanism, is called hydrolytic activity. And that's basically an interaction between the fat and any moisture, so water. And it basically breaks the fat molecules up. And what's characteristic of those two different ways that a fat can go rancid are sort of different byproducts. And what's really interesting is the byproducts of oxidative degradation of fats are far more toxic than the byproducts of hydrolytic oxidation of fats. And then the third method, because I did mention that there were three methods that a fat can go rancid, is from microbial activity. So that is bacteria that, or molds, for example, that can break those fats apart. So Dr. Kayla Daniel did these sort of stereotypical tests that they're used for food safety to address whether or not these fats were rancid. So looking at the oxidation mechanisms, she looked at peroxide, which is a, you know, stereotypical byproduct of oxidative damage to fats. It builds up over time, but then it hits a maximum. So you don't basically have the right substrate to produce it anymore. And then the peroxide will start to degrade and it will start to die off. So the peroxide levels were found to be in the normal range. Between the labs, between 0.2 and 2.42 MEQ per kilogram. The acceptable cutoff is 6, so that's well below what that cutoff is where you would start to call that fat rancid. And Dr. Daniel argues that this low value is actually indicative of very advanced rancidity. And I want to talk about that because it's true that once the fat has gone so rancid that it can no longer make any new peroxide, the peroxide will start to degrade. And so you'll sort of see this peak and then it'll start to come off. But what then was measured was, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this chemical right, anisodyne. If I'm not pronouncing that correctly, it's, you know when you learn words from reading them and then you find out that you say it cassava, but it's really cassava, right? You know when that happens?
I thought that was because you were Canadian.
Okay, we'll blame my Canadianism. But anisodyne is specifically looking at some of the byproducts that are produced as peroxide degrades. And anisodyne was also normal to low. And so between those two numbers, it doesn't really look like there's rancidity via oxidation. And so that's been one of the things that's been really targeted in a lot of the back and forths in these arguments. However, the measurement of hydrolytic degradation of fats is called free fatty acids. And the free fatty acids were found to be exceptionally high. So the allowable limit for fish oil supplements, if you were going to buy a fish oil supplement, is 7%. And you typically get it in the range of 2 to 5%. And what Dr. Daniel's samples came back as was between 16 and 40% free fatty acid content. And that is really interesting because it's what happens with free fatty acids is basically simple fat molecules like triglycerides, or sort of three fats, you know, held together with a glycerol bridge, are being broken up into free fatty acids. And that is definitely considered a marker of rancidity. However, it's not really well understood what happens if you eat them. So, for example, if your body, if your blood has a lot of free fatty acids in it, that's bad. But if you eat them, does that mean your blood levels of free fatty acids are going to increase? And it's not clear. So, or at least certainly in the amount of time that I had to research this, I was not able to find a really solid answer to that question. And it's interesting because there's this, if it was oxidized fats in fermented cod liver oil, which it doesn't look like it is, then that would be something that you would see really quickly in the health of people taking it on a daily basis. But free fatty acids as a marker of rancidity, it's unclear whether or not that's going to be something that's going to show up in sort of health detriment. And it's unclear to me if you consume large doses of free fatty acids, if that's going to increase blood free fatty acids. If it did, that would be bad. And so And so this is actually Dr. Daniel's major argument for fermented cod liver oil being rancid. And it's an exceptionally valid argument. I think the question then becomes, is there something good in fermented cod liver oil that makes up for these free fatty acids? She looked at some other things. So she looked at biogenic amines. So these are amino acids that have been converted by an enzyme, and that the classic one is the amino acid histidine converted into the amino acid histamine. And if you have histamine intolerance, chances are really good you have intolerance to other biogenic amines. And this is actually discussed in detail in the Paleo Approach. Believe it or not, this is one thing I already knew about. So while they didn't find high levels of histamine, they found some other biogenic amines, including tyramine, which is a really common sensitivity. And this could explain why some people have reactions to fermented cod liver oil. Then one of the other tests that Dr. Daniel did was looking at the vitamin content. And this is really interesting because we've always talked, when we have talked about fermented cod liver oil, we've talked about it as not being a great omega-3 source because of concerns about the fats being damaged. And I think I always assumed it would be oxidative damage, not hydrolytic damage, but clearly that's now in question. But we've always talked about it being, not thinking of it as a omega-3 fatty acid supplement, but thinking of it instead as a fat-soluble vitamin supplement. And it's sort of promoted to have a lot of vitamin A, a lot of vitamin D, and a lot of vitamin K2. And so it turns out that the levels of those from the testing that Dr. Daniel did was substantially lower than what you would hope for. Like, and much lower than what you would get from fresh seafood. And that goes to, you know, marketing claims, right? So this is going to be some interesting talk because there's some back and forth in the community that's worth discussing here. So one of the things that came out of this testing was that the omega-3 content was not particularly high. I don't think that's especially a surprise, that the fat-soluble vitamin content was surprisingly low and that there were trans fats present. This is a really interesting thing. So apparently a little over 3% of the total content of fermented cod liver oil was trans fats, which would not be found naturally in fish. So this is where we start to go. So Dr. Daniel's thoughts is that this means that the fermented cod liver oil is cut with some kind of, you know, processed vegetable oil. But I think it's really important to take a step back and say, like, we're seeing a lot of changes in fat structure if we're seeing as much as 40% free fatty acids. And we know that microbes change the structures of fats. So they have enzymes that are lipases. So those are enzymes that break apart fats. We know that there are some types of naturally occurring trans fats like conjugated linoleic acid, which are very health promoting. We don't know exactly what these trans fats are, and we don't know if they're good trans fats or bad trans fats. So it's definitely an interesting question that needs to be, it needs to be researched more and figure out what that is. So in some of the rebuttals, there is some question as to whether or not the testing done actually looked at all of the different forms of vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin K2, and maybe missed some forms. And that's interesting because we do know that most vitamins have multiple forms, and it's quite possible that the test, for example, only tested for vitamin D3 and didn't test for vitamin D2. And it may be that through fermentation, there's enough of a, you know, change in structure that it wouldn't show up on the testing. One could then wonder if there's enough of change in structure of those vitamins that it doesn't show up on the testing. Is there enough of change in structure of those vitamins that they're no longer useful vitamins for us? So for example, we know that our bodies have to convert vitamin D2 into vitamin D3. So if you get vitamin D2 from a mushroom, you have to then convert it into vitamin D3 for it to be active. active and do its thing. So is it as good if it's vitamin D2 and not vitamin D3? There's lots of other forms of vitamin D, so it could be one of those other forms. And so there's some questions. So now let's go figure out if we can test for every single isoform of vitamin D and vitamin K and vitamin A, and then ask, is that good to consume? Is that going to be health promoting? And so as people have come into this and tried to undermine Dr. Daniel's report, tried to prove that the way she's drawn conclusions are inaccurate, and often by making statements that are then scientifically inaccurate themselves, I think that there's three things that I really want to emphasize, and that really cause me concern. So I think the number one thing that we need to emphasize is we do not have all the answers, and there's so many unknowns here that it's really, really challenging to make a statement, yay or nay, against fermented cod liver oil. But there's the aspect of, I guess it's psychology here that makes me go, interesting. So we don't know how fermented cod liver oil is made. We know that Sally Fallon, or we suspect, it's hearsay, you're right, Stacey, that Sally Fallon did not want to do testing, and she is putting all of her force behind fermented cod liver oil despite it. Dr. Daniel sent her reports to 5 different labs, but did not share which labs those were. And some of the critiques against Dr. Daniel's report is that if you don't share the labs that or the funding that she got to pay for that are you know, is it a competitor who's funding this? Is it a lab who has something to gain by undermining green pasture? I know Dr. Daniel, and I think she's hysterically funny. Do you remember sitting in her bone broth talk?
How could I forget?
Oh my gosh.
The best talk and also great information. But yeah. I will point out that in that talk itself, there was some information that you and I looked at each other and we were like, well, that's extrapolating a bit further than I think could really we feel comfortable with. You know, like there's great information and then it either went to where it could no longer be substantiated or to where it was subjective and it was hard to kind of differentiate the two. But we knew that there was a lot of great information in there too. Yeah. And I think that's what you're kind of
That's exactly my point. So I feel like it's a debate between two sides and nobody's actually sharing all the information. And as the scientist who just wants to see the science and draw some fact-based conclusions, I feel very frustrated because I feel like I don't have all the information in order to make a recommendation one way or the other, except for to say what I've always said, which is it's really, really good to eat organ meat and seafood and lots of vegetables, which has nothing to do with fermented cod liver oil whatsoever.
Are you waiting for me? I'm sorry.
Yes, I so am because I just talked for a lot.
Okay. So I think that obviously, hopefully that information was really helpful for people as it was for me. I think that, you know, where I am with this is kind of where I would be from. This is me personally, right? Where I would be about anything that I was looking into. And I'll give another example. I was approached by Vital Proteins almost 2 years ago when I was using a different product and that was also grass-fed gelatin that almost all of the community was using and endorsing at the time. And I remember Vital Proteins approaching me and saying that they wanted me to try their product and looking at their website and seeing the price and kind of saying, no, I'm not down with that. I don't want to encourage my readers to buy something that's so much more expensive, and I'm not seeing on your website where this product is any more beneficial than the one that I'm using. No, thank you. And then the brand went out and they got more information and they shared it with me and they were like, please let us you know, send you product and you can try it and make your own decision. And before I endorsed it to anybody, I literally used it every day for 30 days myself and legitimately found personal improvements in some medical conditions that I have based on the consumption of this vital proteins, where before the only other thing that was giving me those benefits was drinking like 10 to 16 ounces of broth 5 to 6 days a week, which, you know, I'm already a weirdo. drinking mugs of broth at work wasn't helping my reputation. But where this collides is what I'm saying is that, so there was definitely investigation on my part, both from a personal perspective as well as research-based, before I decided, you know, that A, I would do it myself, and B, that I would share with people how much improvement I've had. And I feel the same way about fermented cod liver oil. Now there's information out there about the Green Pastures brand that leads me to make informed investigative decisions myself. And I have personally been following a lot of the communication that's coming out in, you know, articles and open letters and all of these kinds of things in the web. And, you know, reading between the lines, I haven't seen anything from anybody that discredits the factual scientific information about the rancidity of fats in the product. And, you know, you could point me
The criticisms of testing are all about the fat soluble volume vitamin content, but right. Nobody's criticizing the way that rancidity is tested, because that is incredibly well established and not that hard. Like, you can get rancidity tests to, like, home kits to do yourself. it's not hard science.
And so that's, you know, that's kind of where I am with it as a layman person kind of tracking things. I'm like, okay, well, there's this public statement that says X, Y, and Z about, you know, discrediting this or claiming that they'll come out with information that will prove otherwise in the future, or, you know, saying, I can't believe that we're criticizing this brand that's been our partner for a long time. Like, I get it. I'm not interested in throwing anyone under the bus or any of the subjective information. In looking at the information myself, I personally am not seeing information, and I have read, Sarah and I have shared something like 9 articles just about this particular topic ourselves, not to mention like all of the science and all of that kinds of stuff, right? So we've looked at all of it, including, you know, like the top people that you would refer us to. We've read those. And knowing the science the way Sarah knows it, she can point to it and say, this isn't addressing the fact that, you know, the mechanism of fats going rancid is still not being addressed. And for me, rancid fats is something that's really important to me. I have heart disease in my family. I don't have a gallbladder. I have autoimmune conditions, which flare when I have inflammation in my system, and rancid fats cause inflammation. So I take great care to consume quality fats in my life. And what I don't want to do is take the chance of consuming something that would be having the opposite effect of what the intended purpose was. So that said, you know, my family hasn't been consuming fermented cod liver oil in almost 2 years. We have several bottles that, you know, are like sitting around unopened. And I, instead of waiting until one of the kids gets sick, which I was doing previously to kind of, you know, thinking that it was a nutrient dense kind of supplement that I could give them the same way that I give them orange juice that I don't usually give them when they're going sick. And I also force broth and kombucha on them when they get sick, right? Like, I do everything I can to like throw all these nutrient dense, probiotic rich vitamin C. Like, I'm just like, take all this stuff and put it in your body. I was doing that with fermented cod liver oil, and I don't think, you know, consuming like 1 or 2 servings of it basically maybe every 6 months, because we rarely get sick, right? I don't think that that would have like some detrimental health effect like you were describing earlier about the heart condition. So I'm not going to freak out about what I may have done in the past, but I am going to continue to watch and make educated decisions. I'm going to also be mindful that, you know, the brand Green Pastures has said that they have information forthcoming that is really important for people to see that their product is not represented correctly in Dr. Kayla's article, and I will definitely be reviewing that personally when it comes out, but I will continue to look at, you know, scientific evidence of fats not being rancid. And if I don't feel comfortable, it's not something that, you know, my family will be consuming, just the same way that I once thought that flax oil and grapeseed oil were great options when I first went paleo, and I no longer consume those fats because I learned about how they could have, you know, rancidity and negative omega-6 inflammation in my body if I consume them. So I'm just going to make
it. I don't use flax at all. I mean, when I first started blogging, I mean, I used flax seed meal as like a food chemistry hack, right? And it was, you know, in a lot of my, and it still is in a lot of my early recipes. And I do not use it at all anymore. Yeah. And don't even, like, if I see a, you know, a paleo granola bar and it's got flax in it, I'm like, ooh.
Yeah. So what I will say, and what is my own personal decision and might not be your personal decision, but I've been slathering Green Pastures Beauty Balm on my face for years. And if I miss a couple of days, I can genuinely feel it in my face. And that might just be a mechanism of the fact that I'm slathering anything on my face before I go to bed versus nothing on my face, but
it does have more ingredients than just fermented cod liver oil,
right? But
just playing devil's advocate a little bit.
Okay, so what I will say is that you know, the shea butter or whatever, maybe that's, I will not be stopping putting that on my face. I don't think that from my own completely non-scientific experimentation that is being absorbed through my blood the same way that consumption may or may not be affected by a product that might be rancid. So the fact that it is working for me and my own N=1 experience, I am going to continue to do that. But I fortunately also have a hoard of like maybe half a dozen bottles in my cupboard. So it's not like I need to run out and buy more from the brand right away. So it gives me some time to kind of work through my stock and figure out where all of this is going. But so like that's, you know, for listeners who are like, whoa, Sarah, you just like blew my mind with all the science, like break it down for me. Maybe that can help.
I mean,
you.
I also like, I have not taken it in several years. I did sort of this, I think, you know, on the show, like early on, when we first started podcasting, you basically talked me into trying it. And so I got,
You're just putting this on me.
Yeah. It was all you.
Okay. Readers.
It might have also been Diane Santhilpo.
I was going to say, I think we all know that Sarah thinks for herself.
I do. And, you know, if the only information you have to go off of is this is endorsed by an organization that, you know, has great priorities when it comes to food and it's recommended as being a great fat soluble vitamin source, then like what other information is there out there to go off of? So I tried it and I just didn't see, I mean, initially I saw some improvements in my skin over the first few days and then that kind of petered out, and I just never felt really like it was doing anything. And I noticed a far bigger difference because it was, you know, around the same time that I was really getting into organ meats, getting into a lot more vegetables, like getting into more seafood, and like a lot of these.
I think you also got into Prescriptacist at around the same time, and I remember you saying, like, as you were experimenting with all those things, how much Prescriptacist was helping you.
And I still take Prescriptacist. And so I just kind of stopped taking it for a while. I was trying the different flavors to see if I could get one my kids would like. They didn't like any of them. And I just didn't, you know, I was never really motivated to pursue it. But with, you know, with this information, I certainly don't feel like I want to go out and take it. I kind of feel like, wow, I'm kind of glad I don't have a decision to make, frankly, because I haven't used any of their products for a very long time. And so I just feel like, you know, okay, like I don't have a decision personally to make here, because I wasn't taking it anyways. I had like a little bit of a bottle that was taking up space in my fridge that had been there for a couple years, and probably even if any of these concerns were not even valid, it probably needed to be thrown out anyways. And so I threw it out. But I've been thinking about throwing it out for like 6 months, thinking like, I don't think you're supposed to leave this in your fridge that long. So I, you know, for me, I feel like there's a lot of questions. If I was taking it daily, I would probably be stopping, and waiting for more information and then really evaluating how stopping would make me feel. Right. Like that's part of it too. Right. A huge part of this is how our individual bodies react to things. And so that's very likely what I would be doing. As it is, I'm just gonna geek out on science and then not actually change anything that I'm doing.
So I, you know, again, want to emphasize that everybody has a lot of information from a lot of different sources. We will include links in the show notes to the references that Sarah made, as well as our prior experience with the organization, in reference to the experience that we noted earlier. And I just really want to encourage people to think honestly and openly about everything that is, you know, potentially endorsed by anyone. And that could be me, that could be Sarah, that could be, you know, an organization that you pay to belong to, that could be, you know, a government official, right? I think it's important to kind of look at the facts and baseline, take out the subjective material. And from there, as we, you know, as Sarah noted earlier, there is both, you know, very positive and negative aspects of Dr. Kayla's report. But if I just look at the science, it's enough to make me uncomfortable. And I haven't seen anything else that makes me feel comfortable. So that's my own personal take on things. But going forward, you know, to apply this to more than just the situation, maybe you're someone who's never taken it and has no interest and you're like, wow, this like totally does not apply to me, but I'm interested in the drama. Okay, thanks for tuning on. But also, you know, I would encourage you to think about how else this might be applying in your life. You know, if you purchased a product because I said that I liked it and then you ended up not liking it or it didn't work for you or quite the opposite, it made you feel awful. Like, I sincerely hope that you listen to your own body. And also, you know, anything that Sarah or I ever try to tell you works for us, we hope that you look into that brand and you make sure that it's going to work for you. Everybody has their own, you know, unique requirements, whether they be, you know, food sensitivities and intolerances to a variety of other factors that might apply to you that don't apply to us or vice versa. You know, I can't eat tomatoes, but maybe that works for you. And that doesn't mean that you shouldn't have tomatoes then. So I know I'm getting like way ambiguous at this point, but you know, to me, this was kind of an awakening, like, hey, just because, you know, you think that someone has your interests at heart, perhaps there's more to it than that. And, you know, we are really the only people that can, you know, truly advocate and stand up for ourselves. Everybody in this world has, you know, their own individual intentions. And, you know, a lot of that might cross over to, you know, what benefits you, but in some cases it might not. So, you know, just this is your public service announcement to be mindful of the things that are around you and really, you know, be educated and do that investigation, do those N equals one experiments and really, you know, play with your own paleo lifestyle, as we would refer to it, as much as you can.
Boom.
I was doing so much hand talking there. Could you like feel the
I
wind?
I could. Yes. It was definitely, I was like, I'm glad we are in front of computer monitors and I'm not like in the way.
You would have gotten an eye poked out from how much I was gesticulating with my hands as I was talking. Anyway. So like we said, this is pretty much all we could cover in a show. I think that our next show is going to be
Sugar Part 2.
And, then we've already referenced two other shows that we, you know, intend to do in
the nebulous future.
So we will be back, and hopefully you'll be back with us. If you enjoy the show, please leave a review in iTunes, and by all means, tell, you know, your mother, your father, your best friend, your aunt, your uncle, your coworker that they too would like the show and to download and listen. We are grateful for every single person who tunes in, and we look forward to talking at you again next week.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
Talking a lot is hard.
It depends on who you are, I guess. I could just talk forever.
All right.